Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Congress is back from a two-week vacation, and let's hope they're rested. They're facing a $3.6 trillion budget proposal and major overhauls of the nation's energy and healthcare systems against the backdrop of a recession and bank bailouts. In a minute, Howard Dean with some thoughts for the president he helped get elected. But let's start with Gail Chadwick of the Christian Science Monitor. Gail, you write today, not since the Depression-era Congress has the agenda been as vast as it is now. We could also throw in they're working on a consumer credit card bill of rights and regulation, new regulations potentially under the Clean Air Act. But let's start with the bailouts, because Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner testified before Harvard Law Professor Elizabeth Warren's oversight panel today. How did that go? What did he say about the bank bailouts?
Well, it was a rather mixed hearing, because at the end of it, it was hard to answer the question, what do we know now that we didn't know before? I mean, the Republicans were very clear. They wanted assurances that the Treasury and Federal Reserve were not going to put in place a set of rules that would expand controls over, for example, compensation into any other bank or non-bank that's involved in a bailout. And the secretary, when pushed and pushed on that point, said that while he personally didn't think that it ought to be extended, this was still something that Treasury was considering. The Democrats, on the other hand, wanted assurances that the public was actually getting its some value out of these investments, that it wasn't assuming massive risk with very little prospect of an upside.
Well, we were watching some of this, and it felt as if at one point Geithner and some of the people on the panel were speaking different languages.
Oh, completely.
So if this is to, you know, we know Elizabeth Warren is trying to keep, you know, ride herd on what's happening. What's your sense of whether that's possible?
Well, you know, you can't really judge it from a hearing. Frankly, they're not very good at hearings. I mean, if you want a good hearing, you need to come out with an agenda, one or two questions you want answered. This panel is all over the place. It's not like the 9/11 Commission panel where behind the scenes they worked out disagreements. It's a very partisan panel. And I think that you saw that. But the research they're doing behind the scenes is extremely interesting. For example, the first report that this panel issued basically said that Treasury was overpaying for these bad assets. And that report was extremely well done and had an impact.
Well, we're waiting for the results of the stress tests on banks. These are the tests administered by the Treasury Department to determine if banks can survive. And that's been complicated, but because they've been allowed to list their assets at values that they may have down the road. And so that's complicated that process. But today, the International Monetary Fund predicted U.S. financial institutions could lose $2.7 trillion from the global credit crisis. So, even as we're trying to figure out if these bailouts are working, are we looking at more?
Yes. I think that is what members of Congress are very concerned about as they come back. You know, they've spent 2 weeks with their constituents, and what constituents looking at some of these protests on April 15th and just the calls they're getting, people hate bailouts. They just hate them.
Well,
they think that, you know, the people that caused the problem are somehow getting some benefit. The Treasury has had a hard time making the case that if we don't bail out the financial sector, you're not going to be able to cash a check tomorrow morning. That'll impact your life.
Well, and a hatred of the bailouts was one of the things expressed at the tax protests last week. But you talked to or quote Julian Zelitzer, the Princeton historian, in your column today, as saying that that could be a real problem for the Obama administration, in that the Republicans seem to be more united against something than the Democrats are united for.
Exactly. I mean, when you think about it, the budget resolutions that passed the House and Senate before they left got zero Republican votes, not one. And the stimulus, $787 billion stimulus plan earlier this year, got three Senate Republicans. That's it. And I think while Republicans don't really have a sense of where they're going in the future, you know, what is it that makes us a party, they know what they are not. They are not for taxes. They are not for all this borrowing. They're not for deficits. And for the time being, they feel that they can just wait out the administration, just say no to everything, and be in a good position in a year.
Meantime, two budgets, Senate and in the House, and they have to be reconciled. The Senate Finance Committee today okayed Kathleen Sebelius' nomination as Secretary of Health and Human Services. But I want to ask you, what's been the buzz on Obama's release of those Bush-era CIA interrogation memos? The president said they demonstrated, and he believes, that these harsh techniques, including torture, didn't work. Former Vice President Dick Cheney responded yesterday that there are other memos that prove that harsh interrogation did work. He wants those released. And yet, Obama was greeted like a liberator when he visited the CIA yesterday. Let's listen.
Thank you, everybody. Thank you.
Gil Chadwick, what do you make of that?
It's hard to interpret that because what I'm hearing is that there was a lot of concern in the agency when those memos were released. What the president said was, I had to release them. There wasn't any way to protect you from all these leaks that were coming. It was better to just release them. But he's had to back off that a little bit. Congress pushed back immediately. Senator Dianne Feinstein, long position on Judiciary, now Intel Committee, no slouch when it comes to defending congressional rights on that area, just said, look, we are doing an investigation here. It's going to take months longer. Don't go any further on this because Congress may want to pursue this. And some legal experts are making, I think, a more serious point that that is not a president's decision to make. The attorney general decides when the laws of the land have been violated.
Well, and Gail, I just know I have to jump in to say that he did say today that it's up to the attorney general whether to prosecute Bush administration lawyers who wrote those memos.
That's right.
So he did open that door.
That's right. That's the correction.
Gail Chadwick covers Congress for the Christian Science Monitor. Gail, thanks so much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Well, what about health care? Today's Washington Post reports that more than 70 House Democrats have warned party leaders they will not support a health care reform bill if it leaves out the so-called public option. Now, this would be a new government-sponsored insurance plan that would provide a low-cost alternative to private insurance. President Obama campaigned on it, but Republicans are against it. And last week, top White House officials suggested that Obama is open to compromise on it. Well, that would not make Howard Dean happy. The former physician, Vermont governor, presidential candidate, and until January, chair of the Democratic National Committee, is pushing for the public option, not from a cabinet perch. He was passed over for Health and Human Services Secretary, but from his many new posts. He's joined a Washington law firm. He's a business commentator for CNBC and a consultant to Democracy for America, the political action committee he once founded. And he joins us on the line from Vermont Public Radio in Burlington to make his case for more universal health care. For instance, we want to know, how do we pay for it? Governor Dean, welcome.
Thanks for having me on.
All the analysts are saying the money just isn't going to be there. Your thoughts on that?
I think if you don't do it, you can't fix the economy. We're not asking that everybody be insured from day one, but we do believe that the original plan that was proposed on the campaign trail, which is to create a public health insurance option and let people choose that option with some support from the government, is the right way to go. You eventually have to get health insurance and employers divorced. If you don't, we continue to be uncompetitive with all the other countries in the world that have a system that's different than ours. And so we just, this is part of fixing our economy. That's all it is.
Well, this week in the New York Times, Democrat Max Baucus, chair of the Senate Finance Committee, said he's open to taxing high-end employee plans. Senate Budget Committee Chair Kent Conrad also says he thinks that taxing these employer-provided health benefits is ultimately going to happen because the thinking is that Obama has said that both his health and his energy plans have to be sort of deficit-free. You know, they can't add to the budget deficit. And one way to keep that from happening is to tax the private plans people get. Are you in favor of that?
Not particularly. I think what you want to do is make this as uncontroversial as possible. And the way to do that is give the American people a choice. Let them choose between what they already have, if they like it, or buying into a public option plan like the senators have and the Congress people have. That's what he promised in the campaign trail. The easiest way to pay for this, honestly, is some form of carbon tax. That way you can deal with climate change and health care at the same time. And low-income people who are disadvantaged by, say, a gasoline tax will get it back in terms of support for health care. So nobody gets disadvantaged, and you can raise the money that way. The president's also proposed going back to the Clinton-era taxes on folks that make more than $250,000 a year. Since that was the most prosperous era in the last 100 years, probably that's not a bad idea.
Well, and you know what the Republicans say to any suggestion that there be these public plans with support from the government, that, that we are inching towards government-run health care.
We already have government-run health care. Everybody over 65 in America has it. The Republicans called it socialized medicine then, and they're going to call it socialized medicine now. Medicare's worked awfully well for people over 65. It's certainly not perfect. But the state of the insurance industry today is such that it's about three or four times more expensive in terms of what they take out of the system. And we just can't continue with these costs. So I think Americans should make the choice between a public health option or a private health option, not congressmen and not insurance people.
Well, and how far are you willing to take this fight, especially now that you are not the health secretary? You're on the outside. How far are you going to go? How critical of President Obama are you willing to
be? I'm not critical of President Obama at all. We're standing up for his plan. But if you don't have a public health insurance option, you shouldn't do the plan. It's a waste of $634-plus billion. As long as you have a public insurance option that's run by the government, like Medicare, you'll be fine. We're not asking for a single payer. We're just giving people a choice. If they'd like to have a system like people over 65 have, they ought to be able to sign up for that. It's cheaper. It's more effective. There's no return on investment that you have to worry about, no big executive salaries. It's just a better way of controlling costs in health care and getting universal access.
By the way, I just want to ask in passing, how do you feel about not being health secretary? You seem to be the perfect candidate, somebody who's got some thinking about what to do in health, and you're a doctor. Your thoughts about not getting that job?
You know, that's old news. That's 2 months ago. I don't even talk about that anymore.
It's so 2 months ago. Well, your sense now, I know you don't like to look at the past, but, you know, it seems as if it's worth taking a look at the fact that when you were head of the DNC, you had a 50-state strategy that was mocked mercilessly by Hillary Clinton strategist Paul Begala. We remember he called your idea hiring people to wander around Utah and Mississippi to pick their nose. Here we are now with Barack Obama in the White House. What do you say to the critics of your 50-state strategy now?
Not much. I think the 50-state strategy has been pretty widely adopted, and that's all you really can ask for. People always ask me, do you feel vindicated? No, I don't feel vindicated. I think we did the right thing. The party needed to change directions, and it has. This has been an extraordinary election. This is a generational type of an election, like Jack Kennedy's election was for me. A whole new generation has been brought into politics. More people under the age of 35 voted in this past election than who are over 65. That's an incredible statistic, given where things were 6 years ago. So, you know, I think we've made a huge change in the party. I don't think we're going back. And hopefully the 50-state strategy will continue.
You have predicted that in 2012, Texas will vote for a Democrat for president.
I think we could do that. I think we're going to elect a Democratic governor. My guess is that folks are going to look for a real change in Texas that needs it.
Howard Dean, he's moved on from chair of the Democratic Party to commentary, consulting, campaigning for health care reform. He'll be back in a moment. And coming up later today, the recession as primetime plot line, making some housewives even more desperate. Back in 1 minute, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from The MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back to Here and Now. We're speaking with Howard Dean, the former governor, presidential candidate, and Democratic Party chair, who's now campaigning for health care reform, among other things. He's always also doing a part-time commentary on CNBC, consulting work for a Washington law and lobbying firm, as well as the political action committee he founded, Democracy for America. Governor Dean, let's start with Democracy for America. On the DFA website, you write that once leaders get elected, they get tied to a culture of incumbency and insular thinking dominated by special interests. Do you think Barack Obama is one of those leaders who gets tied to a culture of incumbency or compromise?
Well, it's always harder inside the White House, and obviously the president's going to have to make some compromises. But I just think it's important that we not compromise the core values that he ran on. And so far, he's been great at not doing that. I think he's had a very, very good first 100 days. But it's really going to be tough on some of these issues like healthcare. And there are compromises that you can make without giving away the store, and then your compromises you can make which totally undo what you're trying to do. And we want to support the president we elected. So, there are some things that I've disagreed with the president on, but by and large, I think he's done a terrific job.
One of the things that comes to mind is right after Obama took office, he had foreign policy conversations about Russia. There might be a quid pro quo of the U.S. suspending some missile defense plans in exchange for Russian support against Iran. And you spoke out at that time. You said, well, hold on a second. We have to be conscious of Russia's attitude towards some of its neighbors. Don't give away too much.
Yeah, I think you have to be careful. Russia has not had a history of being a good citizen in the world. I do think that reengaging with people who have been hostile to us is, in general, a very, very good tactic. I was very pleased to see the president's action on Cuba, very pleased to see that there were no fireworks at the Summit of the Americas. There's no reason that we can't talk to people who are hostile to ourselves and our allies, and I think the president's right to do that in Russia. And perhaps this bargain is a good bargain, but the Russians don't have a history of keeping their word, and they do have a history of oppressing nations, smaller nations nearby, and I think we have to be mindful of that.
Do you think that President Obama made a mistake in being too friendly with Hugo Chavez?
Absolutely not. Mm-hmm. I mean, people, you know, you can't, I don't know what it is with these people who think that you have to spit on the floor when people you disagree with walk by. I mean, that's old Cold War politics, and we've got to get rid of that. I thought the president has done so well in his two major foreign trips so far, one to the G20 and the other to the Organization of American States. That was George Bush's huge problem, is that he allowed petulance to run American foreign policy. You can't do that. You have to be a real president. I think Barack Obama has been a real president.
Howard Dean, where do you see yourself fitting in? We read that when you go speak to liberal parties in other countries, in England, for instance, they treated you like royalty. They said that you were the mother of something that Obama the child prospered from, that, you know, you lay the groundwork. Others are saying you're sort of the parallel reality Newt Gingrich. You know, you're sort of the exiled from the party who can now speak out and prod the party from outside. You know, who are you now?
Well, I'm a part-time consultant to a good law firm in Washington, a part-time consultant to Democracy for America. I have a 0-3 early childhood program going on in East New York, and a contributor to CNBC. I mean, I have lots of different things. But basically, I am somebody who has strong convictions about how to run the country and what should be done, and I am now in a position to be able to pretty much say what I please.
And are you a future presidential candidate?
I think that's highly unlikely, but, you know, in politics, you never say never.
Never say never. Well, and what about the last time you ran for president? This is probably the last time we'll ask you about it. Some said your style then was too confrontational, and then there was that yell on the campaign trail. How do you look back on that now?
Well, the yell at the campaign trail thing was mostly manufactured by the cable TV stations. As the print reporters that were in the room will tell you, it was like being in the room with a jet engine, and the sound was manipulated so that you know, it didn't sound like that.
And it sounds like you're still defensive about that yell.
No, I'm just telling the truth. I mean, it's just, you know, it wasn't. I mean, it was a yell, but there were so many people, nobody heard me except for the people on the cable television with their microphones plugged in. I mean, I think people think I'm confrontational because I don't mind saying it the way it is. You know, I don't consider myself particularly confrontational.
Any adjustment for your new role post not just the campaign, but not receiving a seat in the House? Is there any adjustment for who you are now?
Well, I am free to say the things that I think need to be said, and that's always a pleasure. I always did that when I was governor. One of the things that's interesting, look, there's some really fundamental things that have to be changed, and what we need more than anything else in the country is long-term planning. One of the things I like about President Obama enormously is he gets that things are connected. You can't just fix the banks and hope people go out and spend money and turn the economy around. If you don't change the healthcare system and relieve the General Motors and the Caterpillars and the steel companies of this incredible burden that we have uniquely in America of being healthcare companies as well as industrial companies, then you really haven't fixed the economy. We'll be back here in 10 or 15 years. That's something I've cared about for a long time. You've got to think of the long-term impacts of what you do, not just the short-term impacts.
Yeah. One last question, bringing us back to current events. You're considered the father of grassroots politics because of your 2004 presidential campaign and how it harnessed the power of the Internet. Your thoughts on the partly grassroots, partly AstroTurf, you know, fake grassroots, top-down Republican Tea Party protests?
It's not my job to tell the Republicans what to do, although I think we'd be a healthier country if we had an opposition party that was constructive. They've got a long way to go. They have a real problem. Their demographics don't look anything like America's demographics. And I think the Republican Party really is the party of no alternatives and say no to everything and no compromise on anything. And I that's just not going to get them to the White House again unless we make a huge blunder on our party.
Governor Dean, thank you. Howard Dean, former governor, presidential candidate, and Democratic Party chair, now a part-time consultant to a Washington law firm, CNBC business commentator, and activist for health care reform, and as we heard, still staunch Democrat. Well, tomorrow on Here and Now, a snapshot of America's farms. More going organic, and women and minority farmers are on the rise. What does that mean for food in America? And the woman who was Kurt Vonnegut's lover, then friend, now memoirist. We'll hear his letters to her over several decades. That's tomorrow. Still ahead today on the eve of elections, how has South Africa changed since the end of apartheid? After the news, Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. A tall, blonde, 22-year-old medical student featured in a 2007 Boston Globe photograph showing off his new doctor's jacket at Boston University's annual White Coat Day was arraigned today on charges of fatally shooting one woman and armed robbery of another. Philip Markoff pled not guilty and is being held without bail. He was picked up yesterday after an extensive manhunt. He's also a suspect in a third case in Warwick, Rhode Island. All three women in the three separate attacks had advertised for erotic services on Craigslist and booked hotel rooms. Police had said earlier that pictures from security cameras at the hotels had led over to over 150 tips. Here now, Steve Brown was in the Edward Brooke courthouse for today's arraignment. Steve, first of all, did police say that people identified Philip Markoff from the security pictures?
They're saying he looks an awful lot like the people, the person in that those security pictures from the two hotels in Boston and the hotel in Warwick, Rhode Island. And that's one of the things that led them to Markoff.
There were rumors that the weapon used in the murder of Julissa Brisman in one of his one of the alleged attacks was found. What did the police say about a gun?
They said that once they made an arrest of Markoff yesterday, they executed a search warrant at his home in Quincy, just south of Boston, and that at that that apartment they found a semi-automatic weapon. Prosecutors aren't saying at this point whether or not that is the murder weapon, but they did find a gun at his residence, and right now that gun is going through ballistics testing.
What other evidence did police present?
Well, the computer evidence is really the key thing that has linked Markoff to these crimes. The police have been going through and working with a whole variety of law enforcement agencies, everything from the FBI to Secret Service to Boston University Police, Transit Police, and they've been linking together the Internet Protocol address. That's the IP address that whenever you log onto a computer, you go on the Internet. That's sort of a breadcrumb that tells you where you're there. And they've been able to link his IP address to those of the victims.
Well, authorities have been saying that Markoff was a predator. They've pled with other victims to come forward. But given the nature of the business that these women were conducting in these hotel rooms, some offering erotic massage, private lap dances, have they said that anyone has come forward?
They are still the prosecutor, district attorney Dan Conley of Suffolk County is urging anyone, and he's stressing that they're not going to hold anyone accountable for any services that they may have been putting out. There might be illegal services, the massages, anything that borders on prostitution or anything like that. He's stressing that they're not going to go after that. They want to build a case against Philip Markoff, and so he has put the call out that any potential victims, and Conley says that they think that it's possible that he has done this before. He said that Markoff probably thought that he was going to get away with this. So again, they're stressing to anyone who may have been advertising these services, who may have been a victim, to come forward.
Well, and meanwhile, this is revealing many double lives. Some of the women that were offering these services, their friends didn't know they were doing it. The suspect himself, a medical student, engaged to be married. His fiancée, Megan McAllister, said in an email to Good Morning America that he wouldn't hurt a fly. What did he appear like in the courtroom, and what was the scene in the courtroom?
It was extremely crowded in the courtroom. This case has drawn so much attention. A lot of courthouse workers who have pretty much seen everybody and everything come through that courthouse, they wanted to get a glimpse of this guy. As far as they could tell, there was no family members from Philip Markov in the courtroom. No one was identified as such, although Jalissa's Brisman's father was in the courtroom. He didn't have anything to say to the media or anyone in the courtroom. He just sat in the front row. As far as Markov is concerned, he came in with handcuffs and shackles and really didn't say a word during the entire proceeding.
WBUR reporter Steve Brown, who was at the Edward Brooke Courthouse today when Philip Markov was arraigned. And just briefly, Steve, in the few seconds we have, what happens now?
They'll be back in court in May, although there will probably be an indictment in Superior Court that will bump these charges up even more severe.
Steve Brown, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And we'll be back in just half a minute, here and now. Whatever happened to good old-fashioned escapism? You can't get away from the headlines. The recession's now hit prime time. Even Ugly Betty's completely narcissistic magazine executive, Wilhelmina, played by Vanessa Williams, is downsizing.
Good grief, what the hell is this? Mark! What is this?
It's an almond. And that's seltzer.
Oh! Where is the beluga? Where's the Krug?
We can't afford it with our new office budget. I was worried that you might react this way, but remember, you said that you wanted to make sacrifices.
Right, you're right. This is exactly what I was talking about. It's what we need.
Over at 30 Rock, the cuts are more dramatic for Alec Baldwin and Tina Fey.
Our parent company, Shinehart Wigs, is announcing losses this quarter for the first time since the Civil War. And even I am not immune. I had to let Jonathan go today.
Oh, my God. How did he take it?
Better than I expected.
Can't live if living is without you.
Okay, last verse, Jonathan.
I can't live.
For more on recession TV, we're joined by Baltimore Sun TV critic David Zurawiec. David, welcome.
Oh, I'm happy to be here. I'm still laughing from that 30 Rock clip.
Where's Jonathan? Well, people have been taking a look at this. In the opulent 80s, we had Dynasty and Dallas. Then when the recession hit in the late 80s, 90s, we got Roseanne, you know, blue-collar blues. So do you think we're going to see more storylines revolve around the current recession?
I think we will be seeing more of it. But there's a fundamental tension here that I think television will only go so far with it because, you know, don't forget the fundamental mission of network television, at least the stuff we just listened to, is really to sell products. And it really does present a sort of vision or an ideology of an abundant America. Now, the people who make television cannot possibly ignore what's going on in the country. So they do bring in sort of subplots, jokes, references like the ones we just heard. And the one on 30 Rock is just brilliant, by the way.
Let's listen to one from Desperate Housewives. Now, this is where Carlos has taken over a financial firm. He's not blind anymore, by the way, if you've only been following the program intermittently. And so Carlos has hired a real shark to go after big deals, and she's using the recession to inspire employees to work harder.
All right, we should break for lunch.
No, until this deal closes, we work through lunch. But as a consolation, we'll also be working nights. If we're successful, those of you on commission stand to do very well, and those of you who aren't, well, you get to keep your jobs, which in this economy is a bonus all by itself.
David, reflecting reality, mocking management, what's happening there?
You know, I think a little bit of both, but I think it'll only go so far. You know, you perfectly alluded to the late 80s, early 90s when we had Roseanne started in 88. Rock on Fox about a blue-collar garbage worker in Baltimore with the brilliant Charles Dutton in 91. And then Married with Children came on Fox in 87 as well. There really was a period where I thought television was going to seriously embrace blue-collar characters, and all that implied, you know, about social class and all that. But that was where it ended, and we did really back off from there. I think it is really in a fundamental class way really threatening the American television to go too far with this.
Right.
Although I have to say, you know, if it gets worse, if the economy keeps getting worse, what are you going to do except acknowledge it?
Right. Also, just I just want to ask you about this aspect. We heard the ugly Betty scene with Wilhelmina. That was hilarious when she threw the almond at her assistant. But in another scene that I happened to tune into on my way to watching The Office, these characters in this completely narcissistic fashion world were sitting around and talking about how Wall Street was collapsing and how they were going to have to change their lives. And there was no punchline. It was like they were trying to suddenly have some sort of telethon or something in the middle of the show. It might not work on some of these shows.
You know, even on Roseanne, as dark as that show could get about for a sitcom, for a network sitcom about the economy, you never had the sense that the Connors were going to be, the family in it, that they were going to be either homeless, you know, or out on the streets, that the whole bottom was going to fall out. There's always a sense, I think, with American television that there's some kind of safety net out there, you know? And in real life, we are feeling like, oh, maybe there's not any right. kind of safety net. I think HBO, I think some of the cable channels can go there and probably will in their dramas.
Well, there is another network show on the air right now that is also mirroring the times. It's called Lie to Me. Tim Roth stars as the head of a group that can detect when people lie by looking at their body language. And in this scene, the investigators interview a Bernie Madoff-like character.
Do you ever stop to think maybe there's a reason that they hate you so much?
I was carrying the losses forward, son. And I had every intention of paying the money back in a couple of good quarters. I'm not stealing anything.
You mean you weren't stealing anything?
That's what I said.
You know, we've had villains, the drug dealer in the city during all the cop dramas like NYPD Blue. Starting with 24 after 9-1-1, the terrorist was the villain. This year with shows like Lie to Me, which is a very interesting show, I think the villain, the hated person in America, is now this white-collar liar, this crook, who blows up our lives by his or her greed. And this is a really good example of it. And the show itself, actually, I talked to the producers and they said, yes, the show is built on that premise that there's a real anger out here in America. And here is a target you can direct it to.
So we're seeing the recession pop up now in storylines. But are there shows in the pipeline for next season that center around the recession?
You know, there are a bunch of recession shows on the way. ABC has a series called Canned, C-A-N-N-E-D, coming with 20-somethings who get fired from an investment bank and what their life is like after that. There's a Kelsey Grammer series coming also from ABC in which he plays a former Wall Street executive who quits for quote-unquote family reasons and tries to reconnect with his family. Over at Fox, and this is for next fall, there's a show called $2 Beer with Mike Binder both starring and directing in it, and it's set in Detroit, sort of the heartbeat of America when it comes to recession.
And we're reading that Fox also has a new reality TV show in development. It's called Someone's Gotta Go. And the Washington Post says it's sort of Lord of the Flies.
Well, it is. It's, you know, Mike Darnell is the sort of Rasputin. He's the head of reality programming at Fox. He's sort of the mad monk of reality programming. He's a fascinating, brilliant guy who comes up with these things that really push the boundaries of where reality TV can go. And in this series, they're going to go into real companies, small companies, where the managers believe they have to downsize. They're going to give personnel records, including performance reviews and salaries, to all the employees and let them decide who's going to be voted off the island. In some ways, it sounds reprehensible, doesn't it?
Well, I smell lawsuit.
Yes, although some people to be on television will sign a waiver giving away the rights to anything, and I'm sure Fox will protect itself before they do this. And, you know, you have to, in a way, hand it to reality television. Wherever there is a sort of fissure in the social fabric or some sort of development, reality TV goes in there and tries to exploit it.
Well, and I'm betting that the creators of those programs are secretly praying that the recession linger because their shows will take a while to get on the air.
Well, yeah, wouldn't it be bad if you had all these shows for next fall and the economy really did get as good as President Obama says it's getting before that? Well, they'll just eat the shows.
David Zerowick, Baltimore Sun TV critic. You can check out his blog, Z on TV, by going to our website, hereandnow.org. David, thanks so much.
Thank you. I really enjoyed talking to you.
And when we come back, is South Africa living up to its post-apartheid promise? You're listening to Here and Now. Frail and retired from public life, 90-year-old Nelson Mandela appeared before 100,000 people at an election rally over the weekend. He was cheered as he rode into a packed stadium with African National Congress leader Jacob Zuma. It was a powerful image for the millions of poor black South Africans who still embrace the ANC as the party that defeated apartheid. Zuma has survived corruption and sex scandals to emerge as one of the country's most popular leaders ever, and even though Nobel Prize winner, retired Archbishop Desmond Tutu, says Zuma is unfit to govern, he is expected to assume the presidency after tomorrow's parliamentary elections. In fact, the ANC is expected to sweep, just as it did in the first post-apartheid election in 1994 and in two others since. The BBC's John Humphreys reported from South Africa during the 1970s and recently returned to his old home in Johannesburg to see how things have changed or haven't.
And here we are. We've arrived. Liston World Road. Very pleasant too. Just as I remember it. Almost just as I remember it. The jacaranda trees, of course. But a lot of security. In fact, the only people around that I can see, black men with bright yellow jackets and security on their backs. Very high walls, electric fences on the top of them now. And here is my house, number 29. This is very, very strange coming back. I'm John.
Hello, John, I'm Sharon. Hi,
hello,
nice
Sharon.
To meet
and how
you.
Long have you been here?
This is our ninth year.
It's 30 years since I've been
70s.
Here. When I come back, just driving here now through Saxonwold, it is so different, not in terms of the houses and the trees and it's
security.
As beautiful as, but the security.
Oh, yeah, no, the security. I had an incident where people drove in behind me and, you know, took my watch and ring and...
What, when you were trying to come into your own house?
I did. I drove in and they drove in behind me. They follow you back from shopping centres or wherever you've been. That's why we have a quicker closing time on the gate now.
Apart from the crime, that sense of being barricaded inside your own home, life's been pretty good for prosperous white people like Sharon and her family. They still have the servants and the wealth and most of the decent jobs. In the more prosperous areas of the city, it's overwhelmingly white faces in the restaurants and black people serving them. In the best hotels, the cleaners and the porters and the waiters, black. So, for the white middle class, life seems good. For poor whites, it's different.
Yeah, you can see in the distance the squatter camp.
Darby Teron works for the Solidarity Union, which has mostly white members, and he's taken me to a squatter camp in the high veld outside Pretoria.
They haven't got beds, mattresses and blankets.
It's a grim place. Dozens of flimsy shacks, no running water or decent sewage, animals wandering everywhere, barefoot children. Just the kind of place you'd have expected to find homeless black people when I lived here. But these people are white. There are about 80 of these squatter camps in this area, maybe 1,000 across the country. This one's run by Hans, he wouldn't give me a surname, a burly Afrikaner with a great biblical beard. He seemed resigned to the fact that he is now getting a dose of what blacks got under apartheid.
It's just changed around, and now the white people is at the bottom. Nothing changed.
You say nothing's changed. In fact, of course, everything has changed.
Yeah, just changed around. The black people are running now. And the white people want some support from them. We don't know what to do. We don't know what to do.
Find work?
Nah, you got the wrong color, sorry. You got the wrong color, you got the wrong skin. And now if he comes, he say, I tell you straight, sorry, man. These two black guys is going to come and work here. Sorry, no work.
Why don't the poor whites have access to the same welfare that poor blacks?
If you got a card what says A and C, yeah, you can walk into any place. If you haven't got a card like that, Then you're down on the street.
Davy Turon also thinks the ruling Afrikaners, like him, had it coming.
We were given jobs all over the place. We kept the black people out of jobs. So in a certain sense, we are reaping the fruit of our own wrongdoings. And I say this with great sorrow towards these people.
As we drive back to Pretoria, Turon noticed some tents being pulled out of a truck on another patch of land. They've just arrived, he said. That'll be another squatter camp tomorrow. But for every poor white, there are maybe 1,000 poor blacks. In some areas, like the Eastern Cape, almost half the population is unemployed, and most of those with jobs earn a pittance. The gap between rich and poor has not closed with the death of apartheid. It has widened. If there's one place in South Africa that sums up the despair of the old order and the hope of the new, it's here in Alexandra Township, the oldest of the black townships in South Africa. Behind me, row upon row upon row of brand new houses, just what was promised when apartheid ended. They're modest enough, mostly one bedroom and a tin roof, but they're new and they're clean and they have plumbing. In front of me, stretching to the rim of the valley as far as I can see, endless foul shacks crammed together. A massive, fetid slum with 8 or 10 people in many of the shacks and no plumbing. The stench in the summer is appalling. And yet these new houses, palaces by comparison, are empty. They stand as a potent, silent symbol of hope betrayed. There are nearly 2.5 million families in South Africa who still have no real homes. These women are a few of them. They stage regular protests outside the empty houses. A charming song if you don't understand the words. Let us go into the houses because there are rats in our shacks. And they have gone into them, squatted in them, until they were thrown out by the police. They're planning to return, but they know they'll be thrown out again. They blame government corruption for their plight, and they say they won't be voting next week. Their leader is Mama Tolo.
You haven't got work, you haven't got food, you haven't got a shelter. So how can you vote? For what are you voting for? Nothing is happening.
Who will you support?
Nobody. We're just working with the people. Now, we thought, this is the time for the revolution. You have to take what belongs to you. If you don't take, you won't get.
So this is the start of a revolution against your own black government?
Yes. Yes. There's no better life now. After 1994, we thought maybe there will be something different. But there's nothing different. If there was something different, Alexander won't be like a scrapyard.
Democracy in South Africa is still being tested. And it's too soon to write off all the hope and the sheer joy I remember from reporting on that first democratic election.